He hadn't worked in months because of the research he was doing on Ned. Does Ned know what happened to the stuff in the box? He does now. I told him I gave it to a friend of mine for safekeeping, and if anything happens to me, it'll all be turned over to the police. That really made him crazy. At first he thought I was lying, that maybe I'd hidden it here. So he tore the house apart. I don't know what he's doing now. I know he hasn't given up. He wants that envelope. Is he aware Pete was helping you? Probably. He heard Pete was asking questions about him up in Burning Oaks. You can imagine how popular that notion was. Once Pete got killed, it was like Ned went underground. I think he was trying to figure out if his precious stuff was still out there somewhere. In the meantime, I can't say he's nice to me, but at least he doesn't threaten me so much. I stared at her. Do you know how crazy you sound? I was crazy all the years I put up with his abuse. Now I've got him right there. The gesture she made would have been appropriate for pinching a bug between her thumb and index finger. What happens if he realizes you're as clueless as he is? I hope to be gone by then. If not, I'll shoot him with the same gun he used to kill his dog and plead temporary insanity. Given what he's told everyone about my mental state, who could believe otherwise? I don't understand what you're waiting for. Why not get in the car and go while you can? She shook her head. For the moment, he's convinced everything's fine, which means he'll go away as planned. If he suspects anything's amiss, he'll cancel his trip. If I can just get him out of here, I'll have a 3-day head start. I was shaking my head in despair, but I didn't know what else to do. I couldn't see an alternative. She knew him better than I did. I wanted to put her in the car and hightail it out of there, but I couldn't talk her into it. I guess you know what you're doing, I said. Oh, right. Something I forgot about. Along with the ticket stubs and stuff like that, he had this junky bunch of costume jewelry, mostly earrings. They were in with the rest of his souvenirs. I felt my heart catch. Souvenirs? Well, not souvenirs exactly, but mementos. Reminders of where he's been. I pressed a business card into her hand. I want you to call me as soon as you're somewhere safe. I mean this. If you need me to drive down and pick you up, just say the word. I will. Do you swear? She raised her right hand, and I took that as an oath. Chapter 36. When I got home, I shuffled through my index cards until I found Christian Satterfield's home phone number. The last time I'd called, Pauline had made short work of me. I was still operating on the assumption she was Christian's grandmother. This time, when I dialed, I had a better handle on the situation. After 2 rings, she picked up with the same gruff, "Hello." I said, "Hi, Pauline, this is Kinsey. You remember me? Christian's friend? We met when you and Geraldine were living over on Dave Levine Street." There was a pause while she tried to place me. "I don't believe I do, but that was some years ago." "Never mind, it was just the one occasion. Listen, I hear Christian's back from Lompoc, and I was hoping to catch up with him. Is he there?"
"He's not."
"Do you expect him any time soon?"
"Well, honey, I have no idea. You know him. He comes and goes as he pleases."
"If I leave my number, could you have him get in touch as soon as he comes in? Nothing urgent, but I'd appreciate it." She took down my office number as I recited it slowly. Then I said, "Is he still hanging out at that little bar up the street from you?"
"He's there most nights. If you don't hear back, you drop in after 9 o'clock. You can't miss him. I might see you there myself."
"I'll do that. Thanks so much." Lou's Bar and Grill was right where I'd seen it last, at the corner of Dave Levine and Oliver, half a block north of Trace. The interior was small and dark, except for two pinball machines in the rear that gave off a garish glow and tinkled merrily like the slots in a Las Vegas casino. I was decked out in my usual jeans and turtleneck, but I'd swapped out my tennis shoes for boots, and I shrugged into my blazer, which I fancied contributed a jaunty air of confidence. I had to park around the corner, but the walk was only a half block. I arrived at 8:45, allowing myself time to get a feel for the place, which was half full, all men, and half of them with lighted cigarettes. Like many neighborhood establishments, there was a certain proprietary air among the patrons. These were the drinkers who showed up after work and stayed until closing time. They didn't appreciate strangers in their midst. A number of them turned and stared at me pointedly before looking away. I ignored the hostility and found a seat at the bar with an empty stool on either side. The bartender, middle-aged and male, appeared, and I ordered a Diet Pepsi just as a change of pace. Sitting at a bar alone can be a tricky proposition. On the whole, I thought it was better to be judged haughty and aloof than as a woman on the prowl. If I had had a paperback mystery in my shoulder bag, I'd have pulled it out and buried my nose in it. At 9:10, the door opened, and Christian ambled in. I could see him do a quick crowd assessment, searching for familiar faces. His gaze passed over me and then came back. He took his time circulating the room, greeting people here and there. Eventually, he came up on my right side as though entirely by accident. "This seat taken?" "Help yourself," I said. He gestured at the bartender, who went about the business of making him a martini that he presented in an icy glass with two olives. He seemed comfortable with his transformation. Expensive wardrobe, his hair streaked with shades of copper and pale gold. The spray on tan had faded, but it still looked good on him. He kept his gaze on his martini when he next spoke. "You're Kinsey, right?" "How did you know?" "You're the only one in here I don't know. My grandmother says you left a message for me."
"You didn't return my call."
"You left one earlier with my parole officer."
"You didn't return that one either."
"I figured if it was important, you'd get back to me, which you did. So, what's this about?"
"You know what I do for a living."
"You're a private investigator."
"Exactly.
A couple of weeks ago, I was hired by a woman who claimed she wanted to locate a child she put up for adoption 30-some-odd years ago. Yours was the name she gave me, along with newspaper clippings about your trial. I found out later she was full of shit. But by then, I'd already sent off my report, in which I gave her your mother's address and phone number. I may have put you in harm's way, and I thought you deserved a warning."
"2 weeks is a little late for warnings, don't you think?"
"It took me a while to figure out she'd put one over on me. I assume Teddy's been in touch."
"That's correct," he said.
He turned and looked at me with eyes that were a startling gray. Up close, I could see that his teeth were good, and his aftershave suggested carnations and clean skin. These are qualities that loom large with me. For the first time, I entertained the idea that he was in Teddy's life for the amusement value. I might have found him amusing myself, though his criminal history left much to be desired. A hard-boiled private eye and a bank robber seemed like a strange mix.
"What happened to your safe-cracking career?" I asked.
"I wouldn't call it a career. It was an avocation."
"A hobby?"
"Let's call it a passion and leave it at that."
"What was the draw?"
"I like the challenge. Problem solving. Getting in there and figuring it all out. I avoided vaults. Those are in a whole separate category that's way over my head. I started with home safes you could pick up and take with you to work on in your spare time. The fireproof models are lightweight. Really, just a shell of thin steel walls filled with insulating material to protect the contents from damage in case of a fire."
"Have you ever heard of a Diebold cannonball safe?"
Oh, sure. It was a cannonball that stumped Jesse James in Northfield, Minnesota. Burglar-resistant safes are a tough proposition. With most, you're talking about a 750-pound box embedded in concrete. Safe like that, you have to work on in place, which is time-consuming. In those days, I didn't care about finding cash, which is good because I never netted much. How'd you manage to support yourself? Did you have an outside job? I was 12. So, mowing lawns? Sometimes, sure. You know what the real problem was? Safe cracking requires so much equipment. Drills, cold chisels, sledgehammers, electric saws with diamond-edged blades. An acetylene torch is mandatory, which means you have to have a hose, a tank. Puncher drift pins you can't do without. Maybe a 220-volt electric cutting torch. What was I supposed to do, hide it all under my bed? No blasting caps? I never got into those. Practice with explosives, you can picture the complaints. Your mother and your grandmother didn't notice the gear you had stashed in your room? I told them I was interested in how things worked. You know, tinkering. What did they care? I could fix small appliances, and that was good. I spent a lot of time in my room. I was quiet and industrious. I made good grades. I wasn't truant. I didn't hang out on street corners with the bad element. Eventually, you lost interest, is that it? Essentially. Robbing banks has a bigger thrill quotient for a lot less time and effort. I got addicted to the rush. I'd walk in, calm and relaxed. 3 minutes later, I'd walk out the door higher than a kite, with no illegal substances involved. How can you beat that? You weren't concerned about getting shot to death? I didn't carry a weapon. The first time a bank guard told me to drop, I'd have dropped. Meantime, I was nice about it. I didn't yell. I didn't threaten people. Not ever? He smiled. Okay. Sometimes. In a note. I know tellers are gullible, but I tried not to take advantage. Most were beautiful young girls I'd have been happy to date. I thought of them as my 90-second relationships. Brief but intense. One teller wrote to me for a long time after I went to Lompoc. I can't remember her name now. Lucy. That got his attention. But I didn't want to stop and explain. Instead, I said, "You couldn't have enjoyed prison life." No, I did not. I met some very smart gentlemen and a number of thugs. I learned how to protect myself, which was not always pleasant for the other fellow. Why would you risk going back? Look, I appreciate your concern, especially coming in here like this. You didn't have to go out of your way. I feel responsible. You needn't. I can take care of myself. And you've done so well to date, I remarked. Don't be a wise ass. I can see you have advice to offer. You want to say your piece? Sure. I think it's a mistake to get caught up in someone else's melodrama. Especially those two. You don't find it amusing? Not even a little bit, I said. Ari knows there's something afoot. Of course he does. Teddy likes it that way. Keeps him on his toes. I pulled my shoulder bag up onto my lap and removed one of my business cards. That's my number, on the off chance you'll want to get in touch. I already have your number. My P.O. passed it on. And I'm sure Teddy knows how to reach you. Of course. Silly me. She's the one who set this in motion, isn't she? You expect to make money off this scheme, whatever it is? If not, I got some cool threads out of the deal. I hauled the strap of my bag over my shoulder and slid off the bar stool. I was on the verge of pulling out my wallet when Christian stayed my hand, saying, "I'll take care of it." "No need. I can handle it." "Thank you." "You're welcome. I meant it when I said I appreciate your concern. Christian, those two have been knocking heads for years. End of the day, they'll still be having a good time. You're the one who'll pay. I stepped out of the bar into night air so clean and sweet, it had the shocking quality of ice water being flung in my face. I hoped the brief walk would dispel the smell of cigarette smoke that clung to my hair and clothes. Even as I slid under the steering wheel and secured my seatbelt, I knew I'd have to shower before I went to bed, or my sheets would pick up the same smell. I drove home along the beach. My exchange with Satterfield had been a letdown. I thought warning him would relieve me of any further responsibility, but I was not off the hook. In essence, he'd said, "Thank you very much and get lost." Repeating myself would in no way produce the desired effect. I'd cautioned him, and he'd made it clear he wasn't interested in walking away. He thought he was smart enough to sidestep the fallout. The problem was I had nowhere to go from here. You can't make someone else do anything, even if you know you're right. The next morning, as I was leaving for work, I caught sight of Henry's station wagon pulling into the drive. He parked, went around to the passenger side, and helped Edna out of the vehicle. I went out and gave him a wave. "You're up early," Edna said. "I needed some items at the grocery store, and I didn't dare wait too long or it would be crowded. Mr. McClaskey arrived at 7 to finish his inspection." "He's here? Where did he park his truck?" "He found a spot across the street. When I told him Edna and I would be making a run, he made sure he wasn't blocking the drive." Mr. McClaskey apparently heard our conversation, and he appeared from the side of the garage. He doffed his cap at the sight of Edna, but aside from that, he was all business. "I believe I found the source of your water loss, Mr. Pitts, if you'll just step this way." Henry and I were both interested. Edna had certainly heard enough of Henry's complaints, and I expected her to be as curious as we were, but she seemed to hang back. Mr. McClaskey moved into the gap between Henry's garage and the board fence that separated his property from the Schallenbergers. He pointed at a good-sized hole he dug. "There's your lateral," he said, indicating a pipe visible at the bottom of the hole. "And that is a T-joint someone's cut into your line. You can see the joins right here. There's a run of PVC pipe that goes under the fence. On the other side, it comes up into a hose bib you can see if you take a look." Edna stood at some remove, her attention drawn to Mr. McClaskey's commentary in the manner of someone passing the scene of a fatal traffic accident. Henry and I both craned our necks to see over the fence. The hose bib had an adapter on it that allowed two hoses to be attached to the same faucet. A 20-foot-long green hose extended from each threaded metal end. The two hoses ran in opposite directions, both connected to portable sprinkler heads that consisted of a rounded tube with holes through which water would shoot, forming a graceful arc as each head moved from side to side. It was an inexpensive alternative to in-ground irrigation systems, the prime drawback being the necessity for manual intervention. At the moment, neither hose was in use, but the grass was still wet from a recent watering. We both stared without comprehension. Henry turned to the plumber. "What is this?" Mr. McClaskey lifted his chin and scratched under it, an action that gave his reply a certain droll quality. "Well, I'd have to say someone's tapped into your lateral to access your water for their own personal irrigation purposes." "Access?" Henry blinked. "Do you mean stealing?" "That's pretty much the long and short of it," McClaskey replied. Henry turned to Edna with a look of dismay. "That was there when we moved in," she said indignantly. "Of course, we used it. It's in our yard, so why would we not?"
But we had no knowledge whatever that the hose bib and faucet were connected to your water line.
As often as I've complained about high water usage, it never occurred to you to see what that hose bib was attached to?
Why would it occur to me? I don't know anything about plumbing. I don't know anything about gardening or yard maintenance. I'm doing the best I can to handle the care of a disabled husband. We had nothing to do with it.
Of course you did. Dale Adelson didn't install that line, I said.
I don't know your Mr. Adelson, but the hose bib has to be his handiwork because it certainly isn't ours.
Henry pointed in the direction of the hose bib.
The first time we met, you were huddled right there, burying your little doggy, or so you claimed. I said hello over the fence, and that's when you told me she died. I felt sorry for you. You were probably tapping into my line right then. We did not put in that tea. We knew nothing about it until this very minute. My husband and I are both old, and he's been ill, and we live on a fixed income, which provides barely enough to get by as it is. We are honorable people doing the best we can, and I can't believe you'd suggest we were in any way responsible. You surely can't suspect my poor husband of any tomfoolery when he's confined to a wheelchair and has been for the past 6 years.
I raised a tentative hand to refute that bit about Joseph's being confined to a wheelchair, since I'd seen him amble around the house in the most casual manner imaginable. I lowered my hand again, thinking this was probably not the moment to speak up. Henry's face was stony, but he was having the same difficulty I was in forming a response to someone making such categorical denials in that string of declarative sentences.
"My water bill has doubled," he said, outraged. "You've watched me tear up my yard trying to correct the problem, and that's all you have to say? What else would you have me say? Your allegations are completely false, and I will not put up with it."
Henry turned to the plumber.
"Thank you, Mr. McClaskey. Leave that as it is for the time being. I'll want photographs."
Then he walked to his back door, banging it shut behind him as he went in. Edna stood her ground.
"I've never in my life been addressed in such a manner. We've been the best neighbors we know how, and all we get in return is spite. He has slandered us. He has tarnished our name and our good reputation. I intend to call our attorney and report this. I wouldn't be surprised if he urged us to file suit."
She looked from one of us to the other, but neither Mr. McClaskey nor I had anything to say.
"Now, I suppose, I'll have to tell Joseph what's happened. He'll be distraught. We both thought the world of Mr. Pitts. I can't believe the man could be so swift to judge and so unwilling to consider the facts."
She turned and walked down the driveway with as much dignity as she could muster. Mr. McClaskey and I exchanged one of those looks that confirmed we were both of the same opinion. The Schallenbergers had been pulling a fast one, never expecting to get caught and called on it. Chapter 37. For a merry change of pace, I bypassed the office and drove to Montebello Luxury Properties. I couldn't help but wonder what the fallout would be from the Schallenbergers' thievery. There was no way Henry would recoup his losses, which probably hadn't even reached the dollar amount that distinguished petty theft from grand. Henry would take photographs, Mr. McClaskey would remove the tea connection, and that would be that. From my perspective, the discovery of the illegal tap was a boon. The sticky buns and cheery chats across the fence had come to an end, and there would be no more shopping expeditions for Edna. I wouldn't even have to argue with Henry about my dim view of the pair. My only reservation stemmed from the suspicion that we hadn't seen the last of them. Scoundrels, even elderly ones, are remarkably resilient and not so easily defeated. When I reached the real estate office, I parked in the tiny lot and let myself in the front door. The shopkeeper's bell jingled. At the reception desk, Kim was smoothing one fingernail with an emery board. She looked up with an expression of anticipation, which turned only slightly sour at the sight of me. She was wary, not quite hostile, but certainly not cocky and superior as she'd been on our first encounter. Since I'd been so warmly welcomed by the company's top producer, she was probably hesitant to treat me with the same condescension. I crossed to her desk. "Hi, Kim. Remember me?" "Yes." I could hear the word "unfortunately," which she'd left out. I said, "Good. I need a meeting with Teddy, and I'd appreciate it if you'd give her a call to set it up." I thought she might play dumb and pretend she didn't know who I was talking about, but she tried a different strategy. "What makes you think Teddy wants to talk to you?" I put an index finger against my cheek, tilting my head in what I hoped was a winsome fashion. "Well, let's see. Possibly, because I had a nice long chat with her ex-husband yesterday." I held up that same index finger. "Or, possibly because I had a drink last night with Christian Satterfield, and he was very informative. Also relevant is the fact that I'm pissed off, and she'd do well to mollify me while she has the chance." Kim broke off eye contact, and her cheeks picked up a tint of pink under the recently applied tan. Really, she should have used the lighter shade. She said, "I'm not sure where she is this morning." "Probably at your place, since she's living with you. Why don't you call home?" I could see I'd thrown her into an agony of indecision. She didn't want to make the call in front of me, because she knew I'd pick up her home number simply by watching her dial. I gave her a verbal nudge. "You can use the phone in one of the empty offices. I'll be happy to wait." She debated another few seconds, and then excused herself and rose from her chair. She was wearing very high heels, no stockings, and a skirt so short I could see her underpants. I said, "I see London, I see France." She tugged her skirt down and back and left the reception area. As soon as she disappeared, I reached for her stenopad and flipped through the pages until I found the note she'd been taking about flights and departure times during my first visit. At that point, I hadn't known she was a player in the drama, so it's lucky I pay attention to these things. I ripped out the sheet, folded it, and tucked it in my bag, then flipped the pages back to the one she was using to take notes today. She reappeared and took her seat. No eye contact, of course. She said you should come for drinks at 5. She scribbled an address across one corner of her stenopad and tore off the scrap. "Can I bring anything?" I chirped. She ignored the offer. I hadn't been serious, but cheese whiz on saltines was bound to be on the low end of canapes, even in their debased circumstances. I left the real estate office and crossed the parking lot. It wasn't until I unlocked my car and slid under the wheel that I finally picked up on a line Edna had tossed out earlier. The remark was folded into her confrontation with Henry when she was so righteously defending herself. At the time, I heard what she'd said, but I'd been focused on the showdown, and I hadn't picked up the significance. It suddenly occurred to me to ask myself the following. Why had she said, "I don't know your Mr. Adelson, but the hose bib has to be his handiwork because it certainly isn't ours"? How could she not know Dale Adelson when she and Joseph had bought the house from him 2.5 months before? Had they completed the purchase long distance, with papers flying back and forth and no face-to-face communication? I don't own property, so I'm not sure how these things work, but you'd think the name would have registered. I pulled out of the lot with a quick look at my watch. It was just after 9, and the county offices would be open. I returned to my office and left the car in the driveway, then hiked the 5 blocks to the courthouse. I went up the stairs to the county clerk's office, where I sat at a small computer in the reception area, and typed in the Schallenberger Street address. I don't consider myself computer literate, but this was a simple machine with a limited number of functions, more like a typewriter with a quiet keyboard and no carriage return. From the street address, I was able to pick up the assessor's parcel number, which in turn provided me the name of the owners of the property. Dale and Trish Adelson. Edna had given Henry the impression they'd bought the property, but I don't know that she'd come right out and said so. The Schallenbergers were apparently renting the house, which clarified one point. Then I wondered if they were sticking Henry for their entire water bill or just the portion they were using for irrigation. I thought he'd be interested in the answer as well if he was calculating his losses. The Santa Teresa Water District has offices in City Hall, some 5 blocks away. It was by then 9:30, and I'd caught them in a lull between customers. Both clerks were on the telephone, but one acknowledged my presence. There were 4 or 5 desks with the usual stacks of paperwork, gray metal file cabinets, upright files, fluorescent lights overhead, and a few personal items on the desktops. But in the main, the atmosphere was one of industry and efficiency. I waited only briefly before Mrs. Fremont, the administrative assistant, approached. She was a tall, big-boned woman in her 70s, with a wiry topknot of gray curls and emphatic eyebrows that she'd penciled in herself 2 inches higher than one would expect. She wore heavy silver earrings and a pair of narrow glasses with black frames that rested low on her nose. I leaned my elbows on the counter and said, "I'm hoping you can give me some help. I have an elderly couple living next door, Joseph and Edna Schallenberger. Mrs. Schallenberger's concerned about their water bill being so high. Her husband's disabled and neither one of them drives, so I said I'd see what I could find out. They moved here from Perdido in January, and she's been shocked at how expensive it is. I don't know why. The rates should be the same." "That's what I said. I wondered if they might have a leak in their service lateral. Most of those old galvanized iron pipes are 70 years old. You get a break, it's costly to locate, and even worse to replace. Sewer or water lines break on a homeowner's property, it's up to the homeowner to remedy the problem." I thought I did a credible job of rendering the plumber's point of view, and she must have thought so too. "Oh, don't I know it. Comes as a shock to some. Give me that name and address and I'll see what we've got." I gave her the information and watched her write it on a slip of paper that she took with her to the row of file cabinets on the far wall. She found the proper drawer and picked her way through the documents until she found what she was looking for. The fact that there was a file in the Schallenberger's name assured me that they had applied for service, which would be happy news for Henry. She removed a slim file and returned to the counter. She opened the cover and leafed through several sheets of paper. The glasses worn low on her nose gave her an air of authority. "You're not on computer yet?" I asked. "They're threatening. I'd like to know what we'll do if the power goes out." She pursed her lips while she read the information, and then shook her head as though reluctant to contradict the elderly. "I'm not sure what she's worried about. According to our records, water consumption has stayed about the same." "Really? Well, that's good news. You're comparing the same 3 months last year?" "Yes, ma'am. They must be doing a good job of conservation." "I can't argue with that," I said. What interested me was the printed form on top that Edna had filled out by hand and signed. Even upside down, I could see it was labeled Occupant Courtesy Billing Application. I put my finger on it. "What's that?" She glanced down. That would be the application they filled out when they initiated service.
Mind if I take a look?
She put a quick hand out to restrain me, but I'd already turned the file around. She said, "It may not be appropriate for you to read the file." I thought this was public information.
Well, yes, but some of it's personal.
I'm just looking at the top sheet. I turned the file so we were both looking at it from the same angle. See there? The only personal information on the application is the service address, which I already know because I live right next door to them. They asked me to come down here, so there's no breach of privacy. I pointed to the lower portion of the form.
Who's Calvin Sanchez?
The property owner. He's required to sign the same form, agreeing to be jointly or severally responsible for any amounts due the Santa Teresa Water District if the occupant fails to pay.
I thought the Schallenbergers bought the place. Aren't they the owners?
She shook her head.
Tenants.
Really?
I had no idea.
You learn something new every day, don't you?
I could have told her that Calvin Sanchez was most likely a figment of Edna's imagination, but I thought I'd better check further before I mentioned it to anyone. I relinquished my hold on the file, and Mrs. Fremont closed it, saying, "If your Mrs. Schallenberger believes she's been billed incorrectly, she could always call or stop by. We'll be happy to talk to her."
I'll let her know.
Thanks so much for your time.
When I left the water department, I realized all I'd done was to burden myself with another problem. In a curious way, I knew Henry would have a hard time staying worked up about the water theft. Initially, he might have been dismayed, perhaps genuinely angry, but I knew his conscience would kick in, undermining his good sense and overruling his belief in the virtues of honesty. He'd start to feel sorry for the pair, poor, sweet old folks, forced to resort to such measures. It would be one of those there-but-for-the-grace-of-God moments. He'd think about how fortunate he and his siblings were, able-bodied, mentally sharp, blessed with good health, and comfortable financially because they'd figured out all those years ago that saving for the future, while not always easy, would be prudent. I had watched Edna manipulate Henry until she only needed to sigh and he'd be ready to serve and protect. If I wasn't careful, instead of Henry feeling perturbed about the water they'd siphoned from his line, he'd be going door to door taking up a collection to help them make ends meet. In his mind, it wouldn't amount to much more than pennies a day, and why not lend a hand since he had more than they did? That was certainly Edna's attitude. When I reached the office, I unlocked the door, disarmed the system, and then sat down at my desk. I picked up the phone and called directory assistance. When I had the operator on the line, I asked for a listing for last name Adelson in Richmond, Virginia. Apparently, there was only one, Dale and Trish. I made a note of the number, depressed the plunger, and then dialed. It was only 10 o'clock California time, which would make it roughly 1 o'clock on the East Coast. The line rang twice, and a woman picked up.
"Mrs. Adelson?
This is Trish, yes."
"This is Kinsey Milhone out in Santa Teresa, Henry Pitts's tenant."
"Yes, of course," she said, though I was pretty sure she wouldn't have put two and two together if I hadn't spelled it out for her. "I hope you're not calling to say something's happened to Henry."
"No, no, it's nothing like that. Sorry if I caused you alarm. Is your husband there by any chance?"
"He's off at the university. I don't expect him home until late this afternoon. Is this something I can help you with?"
"I hope so. We're concerned about your house."
"Is there a problem?"
"That's what I'm calling to find out.
Do you have tenants in there?"
"No.
The house is on the market, but we don't have renters. Dale asked our real estate agent about the possibility, and she said being a long-distance landlord would be a nightmare."
"Why do you ask?"
"Because an elderly couple moved in a couple of months ago. Edna and Joseph Schallenberger."
"Moved in?" I don't understand. You mean someone's living there?
I'm afraid so. When Henry first met them, Edna said they'd moved in January. We just assumed they bought the place. It wouldn't have occurred to me to look into it, but they actually attached an illegal T-fitting to Henry's water line, and they've been using his water to irrigate their grass and shrubs. We're in the middle of a drought out here, and Henry's fit to be tied because his water bill's gone up. When he mentioned you, Edna had no idea who he was referring to. She was still having trouble assimilating the introductory concept.
An elderly couple's living in the house? You mean old people?
For the past 2.5 months, I didn't want to raise a question if these were friends of yours.
Absolutely not. I can't believe this. How could someone move in like that?
I don't know, but that's what they seem to have done.
Well, we'll have to evict them as soon as possible. Do you think we should fly out?
It might come down to that. Do you know a Calvin Sanchez?
Who's he?
He signed their application for water service, listing himself as the property owner.
I don't understand what's going on. We own that property. We haven't authorized anyone to do anything. We've continued to pay the utilities because it makes the house easier to show. Not that anyone's looked at it since we moved here.
Well, I just talked to the water department, and the Schallenbergers have put the water service in their name. I'm not sure about gas or electricity. I know they don't have their garbage picked up.
I'll ask Dale if he's been receiving statements. If these people have put utilities in their name, the bills might be going directly to them.
I guess we can sort this all out once we talk to them. As long as you're in agreement, we'll go next door and have a conversation. I didn't want to mention this to Henry until I talked to you.
Well, thank you.
I appreciate that, and I'm sure Dale will as well. Of course, we want them out of there, so do whatever's necessary. You have our permission to take any action required. Perfect. We'll have a chat with them and get back to you. After I hung up, I sat and considered the situation. I'd certainly served enough eviction notices in my capacity as a process server. A tenant can be terminated with a 30-day, 60-day, or 90-day notice, depending on the circumstances. Grounds for eviction include damage to the property or illegal activity on the premises. There is also a 3-day notice to pay rent or quit.
But I couldn't think how that would apply to someone who wasn't paying rent to begin with.
Chapter 38. The address Kim had given me for the condominium she shared with Teddy was part of a complex in an area called Paloma Run, located on a sheltered stretch of beach south of Montebello. Teddy was expecting me at 5, and I allowed sufficient time to account for rush hour traffic. There was ample parking provided, so as not to annoy the rich in their efforts to park their Mercedes, Maseratis, and Bentleys, many of which were neatly tucked into small cul-de-sacs, landscaped to disguise their purpose. We would have taken offense if we'd been confronted with an acre of unsightly asphalt. I followed a series of flat stones that wound through the low-growing ground cover. Landscaping was limited due to a proliferation of pines that left the needle-matted ground under them impossible to plant. The building itself comprised 2- and 3-story sections, set at angles to maximize privacy without obstructing the views of the Pacific. Their apartment was on the 2nd floor, linked to adjacent units by way of open loggias. When I rang the bell, Teddy came to the door. She was barefoot, in form-fitting jeans, and a loose gauzy shirt with voluminous sleeves. As was true of the caftan she'd worn the night I met her, the style of the garment was vaguely Indian, small mirrors embroidered along the bodice, the hem beaded. She stepped back, admitting me, and then closed the door behind us. "This should be interesting," she said. "Make yourself comfortable. I'll only be a minute." She turned and padded down the hallway, disappearing from sight.
Setting my mental timer to 1 minute was a smart move on her part, as it suggested I wouldn't have time to search the premises in depth, which is how I normally occupy my time when afforded the opportunity. I circled the big open room which served as living room, dining room, and study. The decor was nautical, no big surprise there, given the ocean beyond. Pale grays and blues, enormous glass goblets filled with sand where hermit crabs walked, leaving tracks like the stylized rake marks in a Japanese garden. Throughout, I saw bleached hardwood floors, floor-to-ceiling windows along the front, and floor-to-ceiling bookshelves on two interior walls. A glass-paned door leading to the patio was open to admit an ocean breeze. A stack of coffee table books served as a doorstop, all of them lavishly illustrated with the paintings of J.M.W. Turner. There was one boxed set, 2 8x12-inch volumes, one of text and the other of black and white and color plates of his works. I moved out onto the balcony and looked over the rail. Below, a wooden walkway stretched from the first-floor deck across the ice plant as far as the loose sand. Waves broke in a series of thunderous reports, the surf washing up and back. I could see the appeal of living a stone's throw from the ocean. The sounds were restful, and it was lovely to look out and see nothing but ocean all the way out to the horizon. On the downside, the salt air took its toll, and the occasional strong storm could plant a sailboat in your front yard. I moved back into the living room and sat down on the couch. I entertained myself by looking at the family photographs in silver frames that had been placed on the nearest end table. Children or grandchildren, there was no way to sort out which personal touches belonged to the condominium's owner and which had been brought in by Teddy and Kim to help them feel at home. There was also a small stack of promotional brochures for what must have been the infamous condominium where Stella's husband died. I was curious to see what million-dollar real estate was looking like these days. I picked up the brochure on top. A four-fold color spread showed the living room with its high coffered ceiling, wood-burning fireplace, and abundance of light, the gleaming kitchen, the marble-lined bathrooms, the bedrooms, the gracious outdoor patio with its view to the ocean in the distance. The accompanying sales pitch was one I could have written myself. The word stunning loomed large. A glossy library book about Tiffany jewelry rested open on the arm of the couch. The cover featured a necklace that looked like a baby's bib, dense with diamonds, emeralds, and gold filigree. I didn't realize Teddy had returned until she said, "I know what you're thinking, that we've hardly fallen on hard times living in a place like this." She carried a bottle of white wine and two wine glasses that she placed on the coffee table. Crossed my mind. "Kim and I are house-sitting for a friend. We're like gypsies. We pick up every few weeks and move to another encampment." "But you don't pay rent." "True enough." Her gaze drifted to the book about Tiffany jewelry. In one easy motion, she closed the book and set it on the floor by her chair. I kept my expression disinterested. "How long have you been here?"
"A month. We have another month to go. Maybe more if she extends her stay abroad."
Even in the harsh sunlight streaming through the windows, I was struck anew by her facial structure, with its angular planes, the prominent nose with the bump at the bridge. And all that excessive hair. It was a rich mahogany shade with glints of red, thick and layered, with some of the strands forming ringlets. If she was wearing makeup, it wasn't evident. I watched her use an auger-style opener to remove the cork. It was the same wine we'd enjoyed that night at the Clipper estate. "Still drinking good wine, I see." "Oh, please. I don't care how low you sink, there's no excuse for bad Chardonnay." She poured wine in my glass and then filled her own. She lifted hers in a gesture of goodwill and took her first sip, then eased into the adjacent chair. "Kim tells me you spoke to Ari." "Yesterday afternoon. The place is in a state of upheaval.
Stella's doing, I'm sure.
We were skipping from topic to topic, but it kept the tone light. I said, I expected Kim to be here.
It would only complicate the conversation. She's off at the gym lifting weights. We have a facility here in the complex, so it doesn't cost us anything. That's the sort of thing we have to worry about these days.
I can only imagine the shock.
She had the good grace to laugh, but I knew I shouldn't push her too far. She was living in reduced circumstances, and while her lifestyle was luxurious compared to mine, I felt some sympathy for her lot.
You and Kim have been friends for a long time?
More so now than we were in the olden days. Back then we traveled in the same social circles, but we didn't know each other well. In a curious way, we had nothing in common. Then Brett got caught embezzling from the investment firm he worked for, and he went to prison. Now we're migratory birds.
Must have been difficult for her.
Very. They'd always lived well, and Kim assumed his outrageous salary was legitimate. Part of the fault was hers, of course, because she was strictly hands-off when it came to their personal finances. She didn't want to be bothered, and Brett was happy to let her think it was all too complicated to explain. She was lucky to find a job. She's like me in that she has no marketable skills.
She can answer the phone graciously. That's no small accomplishment.
She has good breeding to recommend her, which is more than I can say for myself. Also, to her credit, is the fact that she knows so many of the company's clients, which is both the good news and the bad. She says she feels like she's being pilloried in the public square, where her shame is on permanent display. No one says a word, but she knows they're all thinking the same thing, that she must have known he was stealing, that she'd enjoyed their ill-gotten gains, and now she could take her licks the same way he did. She's a criminal by default.
What about you? Your life's taken a distinct right-hand turn.
No need to remind me. I went to Los Angeles one weekend thinking life was fine. I returned Monday morning and discovered my husband and my best friend had been screwing around behind my back. I'm still not sure which makes me the more furious, his betrayal or hers. Stella was fun. She had a catty side and she skewered everyone in private. She's a great mimic and absolutely without mercy. Serves me right for laughing so hard on so many occasions. Now I'm the butt of the joke. Not in Ari's eyes.
Ari, she said and shook her head.
How long were you married?
17 years.
He was married once before. 3 kids, and I adore them. That's been hard on all of us.
Well, not Ari so much as the kids and me.
He said they were barely speaking to him.
Good. I'm glad.
Anything less and I'd feel bad about myself.
You want to talk about our meeting at the Clipper Estate?
She smiled.
That was well done, wasn't it?
When you chose me, was that random or just my bad luck?
Oh, no. I looked into it.
There aren't that many women private eyes in town. In fact, you were the only one, so that much was easy. I drove past your office, and I could see from the neighborhood that it wasn't high-toned. I'm sorry for the deception, but please remember, you did get paid. It was on the tip of my tongue to bring her up short on that score, but I kept my mouth shut. Apparently, she didn't know the bills were marked. At the very least, she didn't realize law enforcement was creeping up on her. In either case, playing my cards close to my chest put me at a slight advantage.
How did you know to mention Vera Hess? That really sunk the hook in deep.
Kim knows her. Your name came up in the course of conversation a few months ago when she showed up at an open house.
Was any of it true?
What you told me that night?
She shrugged.
Not Jeffrey, obviously. I invented him. Much of the rest of it I invented as well. No home in Malibu,
No travels around the world. Even as I was spinning the yarn, I felt, I don't know, I guess wistful is the word.
So the Clipper estate wasn't your childhood home?
Far from it. I grew up in Chicago, not the nice part. Ours was one of those houses you can see from the freeway when you're coming into the city from the airport.
Ari told me you both came up from nothing.
That's true. And we earned every dime of the money we made along the way. Have you met Stella?
I passed her in the hall on my way down to the gym. She said two words and I knew she was a bitch.
Teddy laughed.
I said, he and Stella seem ill-suited, don't you think?
That's because she isn't Greek.
So Greeks should only marry Greeks?
If you knew any, you wouldn't have to ask.
I steered us back to the sleight of hand at the Clipper estate.
How did you do it?
I have a friend who's a stager.
She must have owed you big time.
Oh, she did.
I picked up a brochure from the top of the stack.
Is this the condominium where Stella's husband died?
It is.
The brochure was your idea, right?
I thought we should expand our exposure.
I had no idea how effective it would be.
Mind if I keep this?
If you like.
It sold in 2 days, much to my astonishment.
That's good news, I said. I understand the real estate market's been depressed.
We were fortunate to find a buyer.
Too bad you couldn't hang on to it.
Easy come, easy go.
It's an attitude I share with Kim.
It's not that either one of us enjoys being strapped for cash, but when you start at the bottom, it's not unfamiliar turf.
I pulled myself up once and I can do it again.
You have to have an exit strategy.
What's yours?
She declined to respond, so I moved on, saying, I take it you made Christian Satterfield's acquaintance through Kim's husband.
Exactly.
But by the time I realized I was in need of his services, he'd already been released. Brett had no idea how to get in touch with him, and I'm a complete innocent when it comes to the prison system.
Which is where I came in.
I must say I was surprised by the speed with which you produced his contact information.
Working like a little beaver for my pay, I said.
I tucked the brochure in my shoulder bag.
As is sometimes the case in conversation, I was picking up a line she hadn't spoken aloud.
You haven't mentioned the story about the baby you gave up for adoption.
I thought it had a certain ring of truth to it.
Isn't that because it's true?
That was another avenue she didn't care to explore.
I said, when I met Christian, he didn't look like any parolee I've ever seen. His hair was styled and his wardrobe was elegant.
Did you do that for him?
I knew full well she had, but I was curious to see if she'd own up to it.
Being handsome counts a lot in this world. He'd never get a job looking as he did.
Maybe Ari will hire him if he doesn't get sent back to Lompoc.
That's not a bad idea.
Well, whatever happens, that was nice of you.
He tells me you went into Lou's looking for him, so you must have realized how bright he is.
Why did you want to talk to him?
I hope to warn him off. I got him into this, and I'd like to get him out. I don't know what you have in mind, but it can't be good for anyone.
How much did he tell you?
Nothing. And I didn't press the point.
This is between you and your ex. My only concern is to see that Christian and I don't get caught in the crossfire.
Her look was unblinking, and I had no way to know if she was really hearing me or not.
You have any idea where the baby was placed? I asked.
She shook her head.
I did leave a letter in his file, but I've never heard from him.
There's time yet.
Does Ari know?
She shook her head for the second time. Then she said,
So now what?
So far, I don't see that we've settled anything.
I was just getting to that. I'm going to do you a favor here, and this is purely hypothetical. I added for purposes of clarity. Let's say 2 years ago you came into some money, maybe $25,000 in cash in exchange for missing art. I could see I had her undivided attention, so I went on. I'm not asking you to confirm or deny because I don't want to know. All I'm saying is that if, by some chance, the police kept a record of the serial numbers on those bills, you'd be very smart to go back, anonymously if you must, and clean up the mess. Do you know the man I'm referring to?
Yes.
Does he know it was you in this totally imaginary theft? She shook her head in the negative. Give him back the money. I know you still have it, because 200 of that is the cash you paid me for putting you in touch with Christian Satterfield. See how good I am to you? I'm not even asking what you're up to. I'd be prosecuted. Making restitution is your only chance of avoiding prosecution. He can look at it as an object lesson. He should have had his million-dollar painting insured in the first place. What makes you think this man would agree? He has his painting back. If you give back the cash, what's he got to complain about? It's called making a deal, settling out of court. It's done every day, just not quite like this. I understand, and I'll take care of it. Which brings us back to Ari. Do you want to know what I think? By all means. The way I see it, you're pissed at Ari, he's pissed at you. Neither of you have much use for Stella. You're desperate for something, but I'm not sure what. Only that you're willing to steal it if push comes to shove. Ari's feeling ripped off, and he's determined not to make one more concession to you. You're setting up some kind of showdown to make him look bad or make yourself look good, but I don't see the point. You can't battle with Ari and imagine the rest of us won't suffer the consequences. There has to be another way to work out your differences. So earnest. I am, and don't condescend. What do you suggest? Talk to Ari. I don't want to talk to Ari. If anything, he's the one who should be talking to me. Good. Fine. I can set that up. I didn't say I'd do it. I'm pointing out that if either one of us is to yield ground, it should be him. He's cost me everything. My marriage, the home I love, my best friend. Actually, you kind of did that to yourself. Slapping him with papers so fast. You could have allowed yourself a little cooling off period. Too late now. No, it's not. That's exactly what I'm getting at. Have you ever been married? I held up two fingers. And how did that turn out? Just because I couldn't solve my own problems doesn't mean I shouldn't have a go at yours. Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but you'll have to let us muddle through on our own. But you're making a hash of it, I said. This is what I find so exasperating. I thought rich people were smart. I thought that's why you raked in all the money, because you had life all figured out. Wouldn't that be lovely? She said, but her expression was bleak. Chapter 39. When I got home, Henry's kitchen light was off. I unlocked the studio and went in just long enough to turn on living room lamps so I wouldn't have to return to a dark apartment. When I peered out the window, I could see light in the Schallenbarger's kitchen across the driveway. As Edna moved about, crossing from the sink to the stove, I realized even her shadow was sufficient to fill me with rage. I locked up and trotted the half-block to Rosie's. Henry was sitting at his usual table, working on the Los Angeles Times crossword puzzle and helping himself to freshly popped corn. He had a blackjack over ice on the table next to him.
Oh, good. Are you having supper here?
I could use the company. Now that my water line has been repaired, I feel a burden has been lifted. I'm not much in the mood to eat, I said. I sat down and settled my shoulder bag on the floor by my chair.
We have a problem.
Of what sort?
I did some checking today and discovered that the Adelsons are still the legal owners of the house next door. The Schallenbergers put the water service in their name and possibly other utilities as well, though I'm not sure about that. The point is, they have no agreement with the Adelsons to rent, lease, or otherwise occupy that house. They're squatters. He blinked.
Are you sure?
I called the Adelsons in Richmond and discussed the situation with Trish. She proposed flying out, but I said we'd have a conversation with them first.
How did they have the nerve?
It's possible they knew the Adelsons had moved out of state and thought they could slip in without anyone knowing the difference. The real estate market isn't exactly booming. Trish says their agent hasn't showed the house in months. God knows what would have happened if she had come by with prospective buyers. I guess the Schallenbergers would have claimed they had a bona fide rental agreement. Their agent would be furious to think they'd rented the place after she so strongly advised them against the idea, but she wouldn't be able to confirm or refute the arrangement without making a long-distance call the way I did. In the meantime, the Schallenbergers would probably just come up with another bogus claim.
How'd they get in the first place? I'm sure the Adelsons left the place secure.
They probably called a locksmith and claimed they'd locked themselves out.
What made them think they could get away with it?
They did get away with it, at least to date. And while we're on the subject of getting away with stuff, I can testify Joseph's no more disabled than I.
Well, this certainly can't go on.
My feeling, precisely. You want to go over there and talk to them?
I don't see that we have a choice.
I waited while Henry paid for his drink, and then we walked the half-block to the Schallenbergers' house. As Henry rapped on the door, he murmured,
"You want to talk to them, or shall I?
Do you have a preference?"
"I should probably handle it. I'm the senior statesman," he said.
The door swung open, and Edna appeared holding a paper napkin in one hand. The air was scented with meat, onion, and ever so faintly a suggestion of burning hair. Henry cleared his throat.
"I'm sorry to interrupt your supper."
She lowered her gaze, which in some people would signal humility. With Edna